When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
This episode of the Agile Uprising podcast is brought to you by Lean Agile Intelligence. Optimize the flow of feedback. Find them at www.leanagileintelligence.com.
This is Alistair Coburn. You're listening to Agile Uprising Podcast.
And welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I am this evening's host, Jay Hursko. Joining me are my esteemed colleagues, Andrew Leff. Say hello, Andrew.
Hello, Andrew. Hey, what's
up? James, the Scramando Gifford.
What's up?
And Troy Lightfoot.
Hello, hello.
And tonight's topic is going to be an interesting one for us. Tonight we are going to discuss undercover Agile. This is a direct request by somebody who brought it up on the coalition, so we're going to address that. A couple of us have some experiences of doing undercover Agile, aka Scrum by Stealth, aka Subversive Scrum, aka my Twitter handle, Backdoor Agile, with the intended double entendre. So let's begin. So Andrew, I'm going to start off with you and your example, your experience of how you've come across this way of working in the past.
Man, I feel like I got to set the tone. That's a lot of pressure. So for me, it was an interesting experience. It was at a company, and the systemic problem was, you know, and we had touched on this in a couple other podcasts, around just requirements. And the company wrote very comprehensive, you know, heavily documented requirements documents. And as a large IT sort of organization, they were not clear, right? It was heavily regulated. There was a lot of nonsense going on that really slowed the process down. So we started to self-organize from an IT perspective, embodying, you know, we didn't call it anything yet, but we were doing some Scrum, not well, but we were organizing in that way. And we were iterating the requirements and basically breaking those down into stories and delivering really at a faster clip than what the organization had done in the past. And what ended up started to happen was the company started to take notice, and they're like, how are you guys able to start delivering this quicker? And we started to point out that the business could not feed us the requirements fast enough. So it ended up becoming sort of, we were out delivering what the business could feed us. So we were actually just running out of work. So it really sort of forced the conversation of how are you guys working different? How is this working? And that was sort of the jump off into getting into more of the, you know, starting to brand it as Agile, and really getting the organization to align towards doing things in a more Agile fashion. That really sort of kicked off the journey for that organization. And it was, from an IT perspective, it was about 400 people just in the IT, you know, in the IT organization. So it grew pretty quick and really sort of catapulted the organization to start really addressing and looking at business value in a different way.
Awesome. That's pretty cool. So now I'll share my story. So I was at a company with probably one of the few CIOs I've worked with that I actually really, really respected. And he spun up a project. He called it the Continuous Process Improvement Project. And the whole intent was, the biggest application my group supported was the call center application. And the CIO's thoughts were, The agents know this system better than our managers do, better than you guys do. They know what works and what doesn't. They know what shortcuts they have to take. Find a way to get their feedback and drive change based upon what they're seeing on the front lines. And let's really improve their experience, which by extension will improve the customers. So what we ended up creating what amounted to a tiger team of product owners, I guess you could call them stakeholders, really, from all the different departments that use the tool, with a product owner of someone who had been an agent and knew the system from the business side and the technology side. And what we started doing is we had them give us a list of all their complaints. We had them prioritize the things that they would fix first. We had our ersatz product owner prioritize the backlog overall. And then it was up to how do we deliver it. And the company was a very strict waterfall slash feature-driven development shop. There were releases every month. They were horribly regulated. You need all your, you know, dotted I's and crossed T's and whatnot. And the scrum master slash project manager I had running the program was one who worked for me prior who had agile experience. And I said, hey, let's do it our own way. So what we did is we enlisted what amounted to a platoon of BAs to write just enough, not just because for requirements, because obviously they needed to be signed in triplicate. So we had multiple people working on multiple features based upon the priority. And we started delivering stuff. Every release we could jam something into, a major release, a maintenance release, a web release, even though we didn't have any web-related code. And we were following all the principles of small batch size and limiting WIP and getting the work out the door, document just enough, not just because. And the business loved it. The CIO loved it. We ended up funding the project 3 years in a row because we got so much success. The unfortunate part was towards the end, we ended up with those big ticket problems where we really had, it would really have been spun up its own program to fix some of these multi-departmental issues that spanned different parts of the ecosystem. But it was really us doing Agile, and if the leadership of the technology department knew what we were doing, I'm sure we would have been screamed at and I probably would have been fired because we weren't following the process. However, we were driving change and delivering business value without asking for permission on how to do it. And it really, really worked out. So that was pretty neat for me. I was doing Agile before I even knew I was doing it. So let me start by asking you guys this. And James, I'm going to start with you. What would lead a team, a department, an organization to take this approach, to sneak it in undercover?
It really depends on like where the organization is. When we snuck it in, when I was doing some development, we were a small business IT group, basically trying to automate business processes, for the customers. And the work that we were getting, you know, we would spend as much time gathering requirements as it would, about two times the duration of getting requirements we would spend like building it and delivering it. So after a while, it just was like, look, you could literally get me in a room, give me five of these like line items, let's just talk through them, and then when we get back together next time, before we talk about the next five things, I'm going to show you something. And they're like, well, that's not possible. I was like, oh yeah it is. So the motivation there was I was tired of sitting in requirements meetings and delivering things that the business could be using in about double the time. It was just frustrating for me to sit there in all those meetings when I just wanted to get the writing software. I wanted to understand just enough, understand what they felt was the most important thing and get it going. So that was the reason that we embarked in our little version of Agile. We hid it under the branding of rapid application development. But it was literally like, let's get in a room. You give me five things. I'll build it in 3 days. When we get back together, you'll get to see that. And we'll talk about the next five things. And we literally just kept doing that until we were building entire business processes and automation to the point where the Java-based teams, the business started questioning, why are we going to the corporate IT when I can get all this work done with these guys? And how are they able to deliver it that fast? And then I got shut down. And then we got... and then there was a controls project that was put in place they killed the development framework that we were doing all this development in. And I was told, you know, you can't write .NET code in this company. We're a Java shop. So you have a choice of being a Scrum Master or writing Java. Not being able to write Java 500 lines of code or more a day, knowing that I would be the needs improvement of the group and they would phase me out, because that's what corporate IT did, I decided to go the route of the Scrum Master. And fortunately, I went on to another role that was wanting to transition. But
so you introduced it, James, and then it got kiboshed because you weren't quote unquote following the process, right?
No, we didn't have the stringent SDLC stuff because we were more small. We were just a small business IT thing that was supposed to be building like really simple stuff in SharePoint, basically using the out of the box stuff. And you know, they misfortunately loaded SharePoint Designer to the desktop so we could go in and just write all the .NET that we could. So anything that we could create custom workflows, and so anything that the business needed, we could literally do with a really simple tech stack because it, you know, that was something that was really convenient. And we got kiboshed because we just started outpacing the development team because they're writing everything longhand. And it was just big blocks of, you know, I got to write all this stuff. But it's because they were delivering the database and then they would write the services and then they would write the front end and then they'd spend weeks trying to integrate it. And if they ever did show the customer, it wasn't ever what they asked for. The system shall do this was never quite right because it took so long from the time they started talking about it to the time it got delivered that it was never right. And the business loved the fact that they could talk to us, give us five things, 3 days later, come back, have a meeting, see it, and then give us another five things.
So your necessity driver was speed. It was time to market. It was you were delivering value the best way you knew possible, process programs and controls be damned.
Right.
And Troy, I sort of skipped you, but you had almost the same experience. I know you were in a small shop where you were basically rolling out Agile without badging it as such. Is that correct?
Yes. So I have a bit of a different experience as far as the enterprise when it comes to starting out. You know, I started out in a startup and kind of just pick and chose the practices that we wanted to, that made sense at the time, right? So we did a lot of kind of Scrum mixed with Kanban, if you want to talk about the practices. And one of the things I had a lot of fun with working in that environment was working with end users whenever we wanted. So we would do, you know, like beta tests, we would, depending on the product we're working on, but this one particular product, we would take that product and kind of take it out into the field, and some of the team members would go out and actually be around the end users in the field, which was a lot of fun. One of the interesting things I noticed about, if you want to call it quote unquote agile in a startup world, is that every new member you hire to that startup, right, is a potential, let's say, could affect your bottom line, you know, because you're really worried about making profit because you don't have a big budget. So it kind of forced us to prioritize things pretty heavily, as well as be cross-functional, right? So reduce the work in progress, increase cross-functionality, prioritization, all that kind of stuff just came naturally from being in a startup. At least that was my experience. So transitioning to enterprise companies, it's quite interesting how a lot of that's almost the complete opposite. What do you guys think about that? Any kind of differences you've seen in your experiences from working either with smaller companies to larger companies and how they're, if you want to call it doing agile, but or you know, doing agile practices, any thoughts on that?
So it's interesting. I think to me, it's not always an issue of scale. And you know, I'm going to drop the bomb in 3 seconds here around my favorite thing. If you think about it, it's focusing on what a few people have identified a problem and literally sort of going with the Cotter mindset, right? Like a few people start to self-organize and start to disseminate that information and form that sort of coalition and build those short-term wins. And it starts to become viral. So literally it creates a buzz. So whether it's, hey, listen, we're spending way too much time in requirements documentation and not really developing anything until we've, 2 years before we see any of these requirements because they're taking too long, or it's speed to market, whatever it may be. It's just a matter of, getting a few people to start to lead that charge, whether you're C-level or, scrum, whatever your title is, right? It could be anything. It's just a matter of creating that buzz and creating sort of that energy within the organization to take it upon yourself to lead that change. It's not always going to work, but at least you're sort of being courageous in the effort of trying to address a systemic problem that is across large and small organizations around how do we capture, what's valuable. What are we doing this for? We're just not writing code to write code.
And Lef, I don't think we ever got to, how did your experience with this end? So you guys were, you were trying to streamline your process, less time writing requirements, more time delivering value. How did it end up if you had to add like a coda to the whole story?
It ended up that the organization moved into an agile framework. What they defined as an agile framework, a lot of us would chuckle if I actually told you what that framework was. But fast forward to current day, the whole organization is scaling now. So literally, the whole organization is looking to go agile, what they're deeming as agile. So they've identified the sort of better way of working, and understanding that this should be the future for them because it did add value of getting things faster to market and truly addressing things quicker and understanding and building the partnership between business and IT, and not just having the handoff siloed. Hey, listen, I sent you, this document, go review it and then estimate it and tell us when, how many years it's going to take you. So they truly started to, the business was forced to accommodate it with IT driving it, but through that sort of, hey, we're forcing you to work different, it sort of opened them up to be more receptive to change.
And I'm sure once you started succeeding in delivering value, they got even more open-minded because it's, again, like you said, don't tell me how many years it's going to take you to do it. You're starting to show progress, not instantaneously, but close to overnight comparatively.
Yeah, I don't know if I would use overnight comparatively. Even there. Yeah, it definitely took them a while to build the trust that, listen, we're not setting you up to fail. We're trying to build this partnership, and here's some success that we can start sharing together and collectively, and everyone can look good. So, but yes, it did sort of spin it that way.
So slight switching of gears, James, before we got started, you were talking about ways to introduce quote unquote agile, not necessarily the development side of it, but there's other pieces that you could introduce into a corporate culture, trying to drive the change to a more capital A agile adoption. You want to go back to that? And can we expand that a little bit more?
Yeah. So, I mean, if we look at like the work that David Anderson did with Kanban, like some of the philosophies is just respect what you're doing today and want to continuously improve. And that's your path to when you go to do a Kanban implementation, you're incrementally turning up the good. So if you can find ways in your organization to turn up the good on waterfall, that could be a softer approach to opening minds up to actually making the transition to waterfall. Like simply getting people together and talking about requirements that they're working on across the various layers. Even if you don't shuffle the departments and create cross-functional teams, just doing something simple by getting the 3 developers, 4 developers working on the system to talk to each other on a daily basis, it's a great start. Visualizing the work, even if it's requirements from the functional requirements document or the requirements document, being able to add that visibility for your business to see that and that they can see progress, that's going to start asking questions. That's going to start building some interest into it. And, you know, that's a path that you could get into Agile by just turning up the good on Waterfall. And I know Andrew and I, when we were at the last client together, we had started sitting there formalizing how could we work with the PMI group? How could we get into some of the PMI groups and figure out how could we show them how to introduce Agile practices into Waterfall? So instead of, you know, doing traditional requirement stock writing, maybe you start that out with a story map so that you could get through a lot more of the, have a better idea of the actual product. Yes, you may go spend, you know, 3-4 months writing actual big full functioning requirements document, but at least you had a couple conversations about it prior to all the JAD sessions and all those meetings. You could literally get that full view, have some discussions around the direction of this thing, and then go write that. That would be a way to turn up the good on Waterfall that could really introduce some more more collaborative methods. And once people start to see the success of those, and they view it as good, they're going to want to keep turning up that good until they get to a point where you can go, hey, you know, this is all part of a larger thing called Agile, and this is why it works. As you can see, we're decreasing costs because we're not doing as many PCRs. Those types of success metrics really help change that conversation. Some of the other, Ryan from Agile for Humans, another great podcast, friend of the show, he tells his story, and I'll probably get some of the details wrong, but he was talking about when he brought Agile into his company, there were basically this IT project that's failed twice. This was like the third go around on it. And, you know, he is the dev manager, or he is one of the leads somewhere in the mix of this project. They were like, whatever you need to do, let's figure it out. Let's figure out how we turn it around. And whatever means necessary you need to do to deliver this, just do it. We have to get this done. And he introduced Scrum to the organization through that. And because he actually was able to get the results of delivering against a project that had failed twice prior, you know, that was the spark that they needed to see, like, holy smokes, there is a better way of working. Let's figure out how the executives took the notice of that. And then they had that grassroots great transformation that was being met by the executives meeting them in the middle. So oftentimes, like when we start doing the sneaking it in, the backdoor Agile, it's that grassroots movement that so oftentimes the team want, but the executive leadership doesn't know it and realize it. So that's just kind of that's my thoughts on it.
I agree with the ability to sneak in some Agile concepts and Agile ways of thinking and working without actually doing it purposefully, and then you slide people into that way, into the iterative and Agile way of thinking. One of the things that I introduced at a previous job, which went over really well, is the idea of something as simple as a WIP limit, right? We had giant, rigorous, defined windows, and there was a requirements window. And okay, well, we have these 10 features that need to be documented between date A and date B. And my response was, well, you know, Andrew has got 5 things he's working on simultaneously, and he's supposed to get them done in the next 8 weeks. That's not going to work. He's way over what he can realistically contextually switch back and forth from. So we started introducing the concept of WIP limits, where no more than 1 or 2 things active at a given time. When you finish that, you pick off the top of the pile. And something as simple as that actually made the work more efficient without even overtly trying. I have another friend who works at a company where the requirements team introduced what they called, I think it was a workbook, right? So it was this giant Excel sheet where it talked about a user journey. And when he's telling me what's going on, I said, you realize there's an analog for Agile then. It's basically a giant user story map. And when he's, you know, when I said that, we had this conversation, the light bulb went off of his head, over his head, because he said, oh man, we're doing this and we don't even realize we're doing it. We're you know, following a practice that's prescribed to help you succeed in an agile environment, and we don't even realize we're doing it. So I think that stuff is pretty neat, how you can legitimately sneak it in without even trying.
Yeah, so I think that's an interesting point, Jay, around just if you don't brand it as something, right? If you don't put waterfall or agile or whatever buzzword you want to use around it, people sort of, it doesn't give you a crutch. You actually start to create what makes sense based upon, now it can also create anarchy and chaos, but you're also starting to address things differently because you're really looking at the pain points and trying to find different ways to achieve, you know, to alleviate those pain points. So it's been interesting, some observations that I've noticed, that as soon as you start branding it as something, it starts to create more angst, or people start to want to claim victory, right? Like, oh, I'm agile, you know, oh, I'm safe, or oh, I'm this, you know, I'm Scrum. So literally, you know, if you leave it agnostic and you just call it, you know, let's call it the Work Smarter platform or the Work Smarter framework, it doesn't give people sort of that way to use it as a crutch, if that makes sense. It really keeps them more focused on actually what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Good point. The branding and the preconceived notion that comes with using the term could really be detrimental. I remember the first time I was at a company and they said they were going to utilize SAFe. The first thing I did was Google it. I saw the big picture and I just thought to myself, what the hell is this that I'm actually looking at? So you're right. I think if you conceptually introduce things without calling them, calling it that name, which may have a negative connotation, you may actually get more, more sap out of the vine, or more honey out of the hive. I forget what the old lady saying is. And I haven't even started drinking, mod on. So Troy, I'm going to ask you this question. So if you had someone who came to you and was looking to introduce this type of subversive Scrum, right? Sneaking core concepts in through the back door, not making a big deal of it. What would be the advice that you would give them? How would you say, okay, these are the sort of things you'd want to go about introducing? What would be your spiel to them if you were, you know, Obi-Wan to their Luke?
Well, if, like you guys said, maybe don't use any of the key terms that people associate, you know, Agile or Scrum, if there seems to be some resistance there to that, that would be one thing. Things that I could introduce, you guys talked about it a lot already, reducing work in progress is a big one. And that's something that's, I mean, easy to implement as long as you have buy-in from the team, obviously. Another one would be to do short kind of iterations, whether that's 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something, instead of doing long projects, right? Like 6 to 12 months, at least do iterations and try to deliver some kind of tested software more quickly than at the end of a big bang, right? So those things, so kind of more planning, iterative planning, and reducing work in progress, breaking items down to smaller bits of work that can be tested. I think that's something that you can do, and you don't necessarily have to call them user stories, just as long as they're small pieces of work that can be tested and you know, potentially releasable or working software. Another thing you can do, which is to me is something that really is at the heart of the Agile or the technical side, is kind of get into the technical side of Agile. Like for instance, Uncle Bob's, you know, his solid principles and all that clean coder stuff he has. You can do that kind of stuff and you don't have to call it Agile and you don't have to use Scrum, but by kind of adhering to those principles and the technical side of things, you'll be really ahead of the game. And I think that's something that people don't talk about too much, but that's a suggestion for me.
James, same question. You got to give someone advice how to sneak this stuff in. What advice would you give them?
So from a sneaking it in perspective, I'm going to go back to the whole sort of the Kanban style. Figure out what are some of those pain points. Like if it's high defects, like we had a team that literally just produced defects. I think they produced more defects than they actually produced code. So one of the things that we did was, you know, we tried talking to them about extreme programming and how like some of these technical practices could be really beneficial to the work they were doing. But as soon as you said extreme programming, it shut them down. So dropping brands, like introducing people to something that is just a, seems like a good idea, should be like forefront in your mind. But so what we were able to do was to get some of the test-driven development aspects brought into that team. They basically paired up with a QA guy, and the QA guy was going through the requirements and going, hey, you know, let's run this. I'm going to write a test, and you go ahead and run that, and it'll fail. And then so we actually got the QA guys talking about test-first development and introducing them to some of the test driving, because they were doing some automated unit testing, but it wasn't working because the defects were still flying out the door, and they were spending more time chasing bugs and debugging. And so this idea that we could sell to the testers that were doing some of these automated unit tests for the developers, it became something that we could sneak in. The QA people loved it. The quality manager loved it. The defect ratio started going down. The developers were actually starting to produce more code. So the project manager was like, whoa, we're hitting more dates in the Microsoft project plan. Like, this is awesome. So it was just, again, figuring out where you can turn up the good, leave the branding at home, and talk to, get a community. I mean, these are like the kind of things that we bring up on the Agile Uprising on the message boards continuously, is different approaches for bringing this work in. Like, these are like great opportunities, great learnings for people to kind of figure out how to bring things in undercover. So there's a, if you want help, put a post out there, and we'll give you some great ways to turn up the good in your organization.
somebody somewhere has to have trademarked turn up the good. If they haven't, James, please do it right now. Andrew, same question.
I don't know if I'm going to answer your question, but I'm going to go off on a tangent. I think that it really is less about how we do the work and more about sort of self-organizing to do work and to have different conversations. And it really starts to me, which I seem to really be fascinated with these days, around how do we get people to communicate differently and actually communicate? You know, we're in the business of talking to each other, not emailing and writing, you know, paragraphs that, you know, get skimmed through. How do we start breaking down communication and start focusing on, you know, people and really to empower them to do work? So to me, that's, you know, it's the mindset. And if Agile helps you get to that mindset, that's awesome, you know, by starting to practice those principles and methods around, you know, doing things differently and how to change. And something it's, and I don't know if you guys have experienced this, so when you start to have that backdoor Agile sort of organic growth, when it starts to become viral and people start to become more curious, and when leadership steps in, is that sort of the tipping point for when we have to brand it as something, and when sort of the innovation either continues or stifles, like, you know, stalls out, because now we need to tie this to some financial something, or it's not consistent and people are now, you know, worried that we're doing things in a cowboy sort of way and we're not talking to the right people because we're sort of self-organizing. So we need to control it. So how do you control it? So again, it's just sort of opening up people's minds to think differently, as opposed to, you know, waterfall may not fail, like it might not be, it's not a waterfall problem. It's the organization has sort of bastardized the way you even do waterfall. So it's just having to call it something and then literally not even following good practice in what you're doing. You're just creating sort of workarounds and you know, resolving symptoms of larger systemic problems.
So it's interesting that you brought up creating the buzz and driving the excitement for people to want to investigate this new way of working. We had a conversation, and I don't remember who exactly I was chatting with. It might have been from a blog post. It might have been somewhere on LinkedIn. Somebody was talking about the Borland Software Corporation in Austin, Texas. If I remember the story correctly, and I apologize if I butcher this at all, in 2006, they started their quote-unquote agile journey. And the way they did it is they constructed an entirely new building for people who wanted to work agile. And the only way you could work in that building is if you were interested in working in an agile manner. And if I remember the anecdotal story, very quickly those teams started to generate a buzz. People wanted to work on, because obviously as humans, we want to work on the new thing. There was rather quick absorption and adoption to going that new way because people wanted to work in the new building and doing the new cool stuff, not the old traditional way of, you know, plotting waterfall software delivery. So I always think of that. That's an interesting anecdote. You basically create a safe environment where, hey, you want to work this way? Come over and sit in this building and we'll hook you up and you'll get going. And I think that's a pretty neat approach. I wish more companies had the capital to allow them to do that, because I think it would be a neat experience. Go on.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's even if you want to make it more aggressive of a statement, create a virus, you know, have the virus spread through the organization. And a virus doesn't always have to have a negative connotation. I know in our world it tends to, but like even when we talk about going viral, like why can't that go viral in a company? Why can't that become a viral activity that people are investing in each other to do things differently? It's such a simple thought, but so hard to execute.
So along those lines with simple thoughts, you brought up how do we make people communicate better, right? Because you and I know you and I have had this discussion outside this podcast where you're very much into the psychology of how people interact and how people learn. And when I'm going to tie that together to a statement that Troy made. Troy created this brilliant deck explaining cost of delay using weighted shortest job first. And one of the quotes in that deck, which Troy, I probably owe you money because I've beaten it to death. You have a quote in there where you say, it's not a math problem, it's a communication problem. And I have actually used that term to describe a lot of things where it's not, much like people say have blank will travel, I say it's not a blank problem, it's a communication problem. If you think of some of the delivery hurdles that all of us have seen in our careers, how many times is it partly process, partly somebody wants something documented, partly culture? 9 times out of 10, I think it really does come down to a communication problem. Like you said, Andrew, the benefit of just doing a daily stand-up, right? Or having people communicate just what they're working on to each other outside of a weekly status report, I think that's huge. And that is going to drive positive results just by osmosis of people talking to one another.
Yeah. So I think even you sort of, I'm going to, you know, point something out that you said, Jay, was around make people communicate different. I don't think you can make people do anything. No one likes to be, you know, told what to do per se. But if you can start to change the vocabulary within the organization where people are talking about the same thing, and everyone's understanding what the meaning is behind it that drives it, it creates sort of that different conversation. So not making people do anything, it's getting them to want to communicate differently, to get away from sending emails in the CYA, you know, sort of mentality where I have to document this so when I get in trouble, I can point saying, well, no, I told you so. Here it is in the email I sent you 3 years ago because I saved my emails from the past 20 years. Just to protect my ass. So it creates, you know, it's sort of looking at it in that direction. And there's so many other issues and sort of segments I can, you know, sort of riff off of on that. But I think it's to me it's fascinating. I think that so much can be accomplished from just looking at it from a much more simplistic sort of point of view, as opposed to this complex, overwhelming, we got to eat the apple all in one bite.
So I just, Jay, thank you for the compliment on the deck. That quote, though, comes from Dean Stevens from Leading Agile, so I can't take credit for that quote. So Dave Pryor has a podcast called It's Not a Math Problem, The Cost of Delay Part 3 with Dean Stevens. So if any of you guys are interested in that, I just give a plug for that, because I actually learned a lot from Dean even on that podcast. So that's where that quote comes from, Jay.
Thanks, dude. And I think we'll put that in the show notes as a link in case someone wants to go down that path. I was trying to give you credit, Troy, but whatever. Good artists imitate, great artists steal. Gentlemen, I think we're quickly approaching the time we set aside. So I'm going to go around the horn, ask for any final thoughts. James, I'm going to start with you. Any final thoughts, any parting gifts, words of advice to somebody who finds themselves in a hole and they, maybe Agile's the way out? Tips, advice, hints, anything?
Well, I go just to, since we're all coming clean with where we're stealing things from, Turning Up the Good comes from Agile's For Humans episode 65. So I've listened to it like 7 times. It's such an impactful episode. That Turning Up the Good has just kind of been my mantra. For people looking to do change and getting motivated about some of this stuff, maybe it's a good time to talk to your leadership about, trying to build motivation in your organization through introducing something simple as it's an older book now, but like The Goal. Like The Goal talks about the theory of constraints. So having some people even understand some simple concepts of the theory of constraints, or how we motivate people, how do we motivate the people doing the work that we're working with? Pick up some of these books like by Daniel Pink. There's a lot to autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Like these are things you guys talk about turning up, enhancing communication, and things like that. Daniel's book is one of those pivotal points that kind of, if you can get leadership to stop thinking about how we incent people, the situation where Andrew was talking about, needing the CYA emails, it's because of how we're incented. It's because there's all of these dysfunctions that these big corporations really instill. So even if you can backdoor Agile, even if you can get to some level of mechanical agility, for you to really get past all that stuff, you got to start changing the culture. And the people that don't realize that Agile is a full culture shift, they set out to, if you boil the whole thing down to it, they wanted to make customers happy and they wanted to create a safe work environment for, at the time, developers, but it's really moved on to, knowledge workers in general. So if you can sneak anything in, maybe there's ways to start changing the culture or mindsets of people, how they look at some of these softer skills that don't even pertain to Agile in general. Like if you can influence leadership, changing like leadership styles, figuring out how to motivate people in more productive, safe ways. These are all the types of things that are going to help you in any form of bringing in different types of Agile practices. It's, smaller changes over time are going to be less disruptive and easier to manage than big bang changes.
Perfect. Troy, same question. Hints, tips, advice?
Honestly, guys, I think just starting with the basics, like reducing work in progress, breaking work down into small chunks, and And what Andrew was talking about is increasing communication. I think with those three things, just kind of, you probably could get a lot of results just from doing those three things, honestly.
And last but not least, Andrew, is there anything that we haven't covered off?
No, but to emulate what everyone's saying, but also it was interesting for me, you know, as a coach going into organizations, I felt like I knew how to do it better than everyone else. And it was, you know, I'm gonna give some credit here. You know, after working with a bunch of different coaches, James being one of them, really looking at how he communicated differently, how he interacted differently, how he would walk into a room and when he would talk, he would smile. Literally, it's amazing what you can do if you smile at somebody. You know, to touch someone's heart, to open up their mind is a powerful tool. And people don't do that. You know, it may sound corny when you hear it, but one coach that I worked with who was a huge impact in me, you know, Travis Reed, literally, that's literally was sort of how he would approach things that got people to communicate differently because they wanted to. It felt good. So it's such a, you know, work doesn't have to be a prison. I mean, we don't all have to hate being there. What can we do to make it better? What are we doing as individuals that work for organizations to evolve it? You know, it's just trying to go down that route. So as you can tell probably by the conversation, this is a particular area that I'm fairly passionate about. So I thoroughly enjoy this type of conversation.
It's funny you bring up smiling because I smile at people all the time. And usually you're right. So people are so used to not having someone smile that they're almost unnerved. I smile a lot on the train, and usually the seat next to me is the last one taken. So I'm not complaining in the summer, but I do sort of feel like there's something, I have something on my face or something.
No, you just have a creepy smile. People can see.
that's definitely it. Okay, gents. Well, I want to thank you, Troy. Thank you, Andrew. And thank you, James, for your time. I want to once again, thank all of our listeners. And I will ask again, if you like what you hear, please go onto iTunes and leave us a review. Feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, is appreciated. And we thank you for your time. And we hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we recorded it, as we enjoyed recording it. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Lean Agile Intelligence is the industry's first customizable agile assessment and learning platform. The platform's assessment builder, consisting of over 100 Agile and Lean practices, derived directly from the framework literature, enables organizations to tailor team, program, or leadership assessments to their unique needs. Lean Agile Intelligence facilitates the assessment and provides rolled-up team results in an actionable format so that organization constraints and coaching needs can be identified. The first 4 months are free, so you can determine if this is a platform that adds value to your change initiative. There is no certification required to use Lean Agile Intelligence. The only requirement is an environment of safety that promotes learning and experimentation. Visit us at www.leanagileintelligence.com today.
At Grainger, we're for the ones who specialize in saving the day. And for the ones who've mastered the art of keeping business moving. We offer industrial-grade supplies for every industry, with same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders, all backed by real people ready to help, so you can get the right answers and products right when you need them. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.